Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire is not known as a farming state, but people here care a lot about local agriculture. Our farmers have the nation's highest percentage of direct sales to customers, thanks to community-supported agriculture programs, farmers markets, and restaurants promoting farm-to-table. Still, working in this sector in the Granite State is tough. Unforgiving weather, competition from large producers, the high price of land are all long-standing challenges. And so today on The Exchange, just before Thanksgiving, we talk with those who produce our food, New Hampshire farmers, how they manage to make a living. Let's hear from you, too. If you're involved in farming, or used to be, or you've dreamed about making a go at farming, we'd like your thoughts. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio is Kate Donald. She owns and runs Stout Oak Farm with her husband. It's an organic vegetable farm in Brentwood. And Kate, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jamie Robertson, owner of Contoocook Creamy at the Bohannon Farm, a fifth-generation family of farmers. Jamie's wife and three sons run the farm with him. And Jamie, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Excited to be here.
And also with us is Beth Hodge. She runs Echo Farm Pudding in Hinsdale with her sister. She's also the Cheshire County Farm Bureau President. And Beth, good to meet you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start with you, Beth, but ask everybody, what's a normal day for you?
So on our farm, we start at, you know, between 6 and 7 in the morning, probably more like 6. And in our case, we actually have a robotic milking system for our 70 cows. So that's being done 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I'm more checking in and then feeding the cows and getting them, you know, ready to do what they need to do. And on pudding days, I actually am the one that gets to start the pasteurizer and get the milk going.
And if you want to see some pictures of the pudding that Beth brought in or some of the milk and cheese that Jamie brought in, we're going to put pictures on our website, Facebook, Instagram, and so forth. How long have you been farming, Beth?
So our farm's a first-generation farm. My sister and I were 4-H'ers, actually, and decided that, talked Mom and Dad into starting a dairy farm. We thought it'd be great to have a business together. And so after college, we grew the farm and added the pudding business about the same time. So we've been making pudding for 20 years.
Wow. So you're part of that sort of first generation of younger farmers, people who are getting into it, who did not come from that farming background.
Yeah, I grew up in suburban Connecticut. My father's a CPA, and we moved to New Hampshire for the tax benefits and to have some land and have an opportunity to, you know, have some space. And our neighbors down the road were showing cows. And so my first friends I made, we showed cows together and fell in love with cows and the idea of you know, building a business together.
Wow, that's really interesting. So the opposite story for you, Jamie, right? You have been involved in farming for a long time, fifth generation, I think.
My wife's family's farm. It is, I married into it the old-fashioned way.
Gotcha.
Her family, the boys are the fifth generation of her family to be farming there. We also milk cows, and we don't have the robots yet. We milk three times a day. Our day starts at about 3:30 in the morning.
Wow, 3:30 in the morning.
And the last milker at night, we run three shifts, and milking gets done about 12:30 the next morning for the third shift. So we're almost 24 hours a day.
That's maybe an incredibly dumb question, but do you ever get a day off, Jamie?
Some of a day off. I get Sunday afternoons off, and we will get back to having more time off as we get everything worked out and schedules figured out. But I also grew up in agriculture. I grew up on a poultry farm up in Guilford, New Hampshire. So we had table legs that we distributed around central New Hampshire that my dad went out of business in the early 80s.
Okay, definitely going to ask you a little bit more about that, the whole family involvement and how things have evolved here in New Hampshire to more smaller, direct sales to consumers farming. I read a headline this morning that said the era of wholesale is dead. But Kate, how about you? What's your average day like?
Our crew arrives for work around 7 o'clock, and we start with a morning meeting. We have a crew of 6 full-time people who work on the farm 9 months of the year full-time and then part-time in the winter. And so we make a plan for the day. 4 days a week, we're basically spending the morning harvesting for our various marketing outlets, CSA, farm store, farmer's market. And we also sell our food to local restaurants through Three River Farmers Alliance, which is a distribution company we own with 2 of our friends' farms. So that's been a big growing part of our business. And our days really vary. We're harvesting 4 mornings a week, but we're harvesting different things, you know, depending on the hour, depending on the day. And then a lot of our work is done by hand. So we're transplanting, we're seeding, we're doing greenhouse work, we're watering the plants, we're setting up irrigation, and then in the afternoons, we typically are engaged in a marketing activity like staffing our CSA pickup, going to a farmer's market.
Because, like, again, that. Farmers in New Hampshire seem to be not really doing wholesale anymore. They're small. They're selling directly to the restaurants, directly to the CSA programs and so forth.
Right.
So how many people do you have working on your farm?
We have typically 6 or 7 during the main season, which is March through about now. And then in the winter, part-time, a couple of days a week, we have a core group of 2 or 3 people.
You know, we've talked a lot on this program about labor shortages in New Hampshire. And so I just have to ask all of you, I'll start with you, Kate, but go down the line. How do you find people to work for you, especially given that it is not a full-time, with benefits, regular hours kind of job?
Right. It is challenging. And it's really important that we find people who really want to do this work, because it's hard work. It does require an amount of skill to get the work done efficiently and done well. And so we've been really lucky to attract people who are really passionate and really excited about learning the craft of farming. And I really look for people who are thinking about farming as a career and thinking about it as their future profession, and who take it seriously. And like I said, we've been very lucky to find a lot of people, but we did have a lot of turnover this year, and it was very challenging to find people to fill those positions. So,
yeah,
and it'll be an ongoing issue. We train people and then they, you know, sometimes need to move on.
Right. And that's something you hear across the board, no matter what sector you're talking about. How about you, Jamie? You've got your wife and sons working with you. So is labor really a problem for you?
Yeah, we have about another 10 employees besides the 3 or 4 of us, mix of part and full time. Just like Kate said, we're kind of word of mouth and look for people who have a passion for agriculture or a small family business. We've been real lucky to be able to keep the core. We did just lose a real key employee, and that's why I'm out delivering milk this morning.
Oh, really? You're out delivering milk this morning before you even came on the air?
So I'm back on the road delivering 3 days a week.
Wow.
Well, we look for a driver, and we're kind of we kind of like to train from within as much as we can, and find we kind of find that we're a good stepping stool for people to start at. You can gain an awful lot of real life skills and real beneficial employment skills starting with us, and we're, you know, the 3 boys are all fairly young, and grabbing people that are all that kind of same age that have
well
some
that's
real...
great, right? Because they're connected with the 20 somethings who have a passion for the land and agriculture and so forth,
kind of feel proud about being a starting point for people's careers.
How about you, Beth?
So we have 4 full-time employees on the farm, and then about between the farm and the pudding business, and we also have a 6 part-time, which in this case is high school kids. So for us, part of the reason we put in a robotic milking system is because of challenges with labor.
Wow.
It, you know, I felt like the size farm operation we are, and because I'm an owner and I'm on the property and managing actively, it felt like we would get really good people, things would be clicking along wonderfully, and then, you know, ultimately those really good people would need to move on if they were going to, you know, have some more advancement ability. So they would move on and I would start over again with somebody new. And so, you know, the robots allowed us to have a different skill set in those employees. We use our local high school a lot, and actually, you know, have had our best success with employees that started for us as high school students. And, you know, we were their first job. I think we counted it, and we were the first job for, I think, 70-some-odd kids at this point. And they bring a lot of enthusiasm to your operation, which is awesome. But, you know, it also comes with having to teach them how to be an employee and how to, you know, how to be reliable and how to come on time and things like that. So,
and how to be safer on the animals.
Exactly. So, but we tend to find kids that, you know, have an interest in not necessarily primarily working in a retail establishment, but want to, you know, work with animals and work outside. So
I want to invite our listeners to join us. And then I have a lot more questions for all of you, including how Thanksgiving affects the work that you do. The number for you to join us this morning is 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, it's a roundtable of New Hampshire farmers. We're hearing what it's like making a living off the land and some of the challenges facing local agriculture. Again, you can join us by email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Jamie, what does a New Hampshire farmer have to do in order to be successful? Because obviously this field has changed a lot in the last 30 or 40 years.
I don't think there's any one answer for that. I think that's the thing that attracts me anyways, and I think most of us at farm, is that it's so unique and you can kind of do whatever you want. You just have to have a passion, and I guess that's the big thing. You have to have a passion, you have to love hard work, and you have to love challenges. And if you thrive on challenges, are never fun till you get them solved, but if you thrive on solving those challenges, I think that's something that you definitely need to be probably any small business. All I really have experience with is farming, but that drive to accept the challenge and dive right into it and work till it's solved.
Talk a little bit more, Jamie, about the role of direct-to-consumer, because from what I have read, that's the key to success for New Hampshire farmers. We're small. We're not going to have giant farms like they have out in Kansas, but we've got this direct connection to customers.
It's certainly been where we've decided to head with our direction. You know, dairy has always and still is a commodity, and one of the last real commodity ag products that's produced in New Hampshire. And we found that the amount of cows that we needed to put on to bring all three children back, we didn't have the land base in Merrimack County to do that. We would have had to be somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 cows probably to support the number of families. And some areas you can do that. Very few areas in New Hampshire. There's one or two places. So we did a lot of soul searching and looked at, we decided we needed to get closer to the customer. And we're not quite direct to customer at this point. We're direct to stores, which is unique for dairy. And that's the first step that we've taken, is adding the processing plant on and the distribution routes around central New Hampshire.
Sort of taking out the middleman then.
That's the idea, or becoming the middleman maybe is more.
Yeah, so taking on the marketing, the sales to the store, even the distribution. If somebody's just joining us, you told us a few minutes ago that you had already distributed some of your milk before you came on the air with me this morning.
My route's half done. I'm going to go out when we're done, finish delivering. But and that's, you know, part of that challenge that you just love.
What does it take, Kate? What do you think if somebody said, wow, you're a successful farmer in a sort of rocky, small, cold state. How do you make it happen?
I think, like Jamie said, with any small business, it really does come down to whether you really understand your cost of production and whether you're developing a customer base and doing effective marketing, and whether your community values what you do. And for us, you know, almost 80% of our sales are direct to the consumer, and we're literally standing in front of the person with the product and talking to them about it and making that connection. And that part is something that I think our customers really value. And so over time, I think if people want to have farms in their communities, working farms in their communities, then them valuing not just the product, but the meaningful interaction and understanding what's behind the food production, how the food is produced, that I think is really key.
So Jamie distributes to stores around, and I've seen your milk and cheese at Hannaford's, Jamie. How do you most often sell to people, Kate? Is it that face-to-face? Is it a CSA? Is it a farmer's market?
It's mostly face-to-face.
They come to your farm.
And not just me, but our whole farm crew is involved in selling the food. So we have a farm store on our farm. Our farm is an old dairy farm, so we've been converting the barn, the old milking barn, into spaces that we can use for what we're doing. And so we have a farm store that's the fastest growing part of our business right now, actually. And it's honor system most of the time. except on the days when we have CSA pickup. And during that time, those are our busiest days. Then we staff the store and are there to talk to people. Otherwise, we're just hopping in and out as needed, and people make themselves at home and really kind of like the old-fashioned honor system.
Well, it kind of becomes a destination, right? You know, especially maybe over Thanksgiving, people are visiting from out of town. What do I do with all these aunts and uncles and cousins? Oh, let's go visit the farm.
Yes.
How about you, Beth?
So our business, again, we wholesale to grocery stores, and, you know, I would say like Whole Foods would be our biggest customer in the Northeast, and then Hannaford's would follow closely behind. We also deal a lot with local co-ops. We are so lucky to live where we live. You know, we have a customer base in New Hampshire and even extending into New England that's really passionate about local food, and they will search it out. And we have some really good chains and co-ops and stores that make it a point to make sure that they highlight those products. You know, our best marketing is standing in a store and handing out samples, you know, and talking to people and having that interaction. I think those interactions are so important. I mean, people have a lot of questions about how we do what we do. And I think as people are further and further removed from the farm, they're just hungry for that knowledge. And so having an opportunity to talk to people, you know, where I live in Cheshire County, two of the largest food distributors in the country are based, you know, one is has a office in Keene and their distribution centers in Brattleboro, and the other is United Natural Foods, which is, you know, one town away. I mean, you know, if I lived somewhere in the center part of the country, I might not have that ability to get my product where it needs to go and do it easily and cost effectively.
Got a couple questions from our listeners. And again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, your questions or comments about farming in New Hampshire, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dawn sent us an email to mention that many area farm stands close the day before Thanksgiving and have unofficial sales. So Dawn says this is a good time to buy a winter supply of vegetables and apples, an end-of-the-season bulk buy. Do you do that, Kate?
We actually just had a big event the last 2 days called Fall Harvest Weekend, and this is something that we've been doing for several years to help people stock up before the holidays, not just for holiday cooking, but just to stockpile all the things that we can teach them to store and cook with through the winter. And so we had a really successful weekend, even though the weather was really challenging yesterday.
Yes.
and we also distribute Thanksgiving shares. So 50 families signed up for quite a sizable share, $140 value that basically immediately stocks your kitchen with all the vegetables you need, either to cook a big Thanksgiving meal for a big group of people or, like I said, just stocks your pantry.
Yeah. Well, I imagine being a vegetable farmer, and our producer Jessica Hunt put some pictures of your vegetables on the website. So I would imagine Thanksgiving is busy for you because it's a time when people sort of get creative with all those root vegetables. But how about you, Jamie? Does Thanksgiving really change things up for you very much?
Yes, it does. The food industry goes nuts at Thanksgiving. And, you know, and we rolled out with our eggnog, you know, and that's a big plus for us through the holidays. But sales just ramp up, and we're kind of a high-end product in the stores, and you think with your holiday meals and stuff, people are more apt to pick that up at that time of year. So yeah, it really increases our sales, and
so
we love
people
it.
Want something a little extra special. Yeah. All right. Thank you for those emails, and we'll take more after a short break. We'll also start taking your calls, so join us again with your comments, questions, personal experiences with farming here in the Granite State. Our number, 1-800-892-6477.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a roundtable of New Hampshire farmers on the status of local agriculture. As we're hearing, our farmers have the nation's highest percentage of direct sales to customers. Still, working in this sector is tough. There's weather, there's the high cost of land, there's lots of competition from larger farmers out in the Midwest and the West. We're asking our farmers how they manage to make a living in the Granite State, and we're hearing from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. Our farmers are Jamie Robertson, owner of Contoocook Creamery, with his wife and sons. It's a fifth generation of family farmers. They make cheese, butter, and glass bottled milk. Beth Hodges here. She runs Echo Farm Pudding in Hinsdale with her sister. And she's the president of the Cheshire County Farm Bureau. And Kate Donald is here. She owns and runs Stout Oak Farm with her husband. It's an organic vegetable farm in Brentwood. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Dan sent us an email. He says, my wife and I have a small herd of grass-fed belted Galloway cattle, approximately 20 head on a little more than 100 acres, Dan says. We sell locally and to breeders. I get a lot of pushback, he says, from very well-intentioned people concerned that no matter how well they are treated, they are food in the end. How do these farmers field animal welfare concerns? It seems like more and more people are going with plant-based, quote, milks. Beth, I'm looking right at you. Go ahead.
So we belong to a program called Certified Humane on our farm because we were looking for a way to assure people that they could feel good about buying our products. It's a third-party inspection process similar to organic. But the whole dairy industry has undergone a huge change, and we have a program called Farmers Assuring Responsible Management, the FARM program, that, again, is looking at, you know, making sure that we're addressing farm, animal welfare concerns. We're making sure that people can feel good about it because they know that the products, that there is a third-party inspection going on, that there's oversight, that we have a relationship with a veterinarian, that we, you know, that we work with. But I think, you know, unfortunately, the story that's being told has been a single story. And I think that there's a lot more to talk about with agriculture and the benefits of livestock and the benefits of, you know, of what they can do for, you know, the emailer was a grass-fed beef farmer. I mean, keeping that land open and in that, you know, it does amazing things for water quality and, you know, and it, you know, keeps that soil in good shape and, you know, and actually a living being thing. So so I think those are really, you know, there's lots of positives. We need livestock along with, you know, plants in order to produce the foods we produce in our part of the country.
Go ahead, Jamie. I'd love your thoughts on this too.
As my belief is that humans are omnivores, and that's my belief, and not everybody shares that belief, but I market to the folks who do believe that humans are omnivores. I believe that I like my vegetables and plant-based things from Kate's farm, and I believe I like them as vegetables. I think it is having, you know, the dairy industry hasn't changed in how we've treated our animals because we've always been extremely worried about animal welfare. We have changed in how we document how we treat our animals, and we're also part of the farm. Our wholesale co-op is, we're part of that third-party farm program through them. And I think it's just extremely important that people remember humans are animals, and we have animal things that we think are human but aren't. You know, comfortable feet, that's an animal thing, not a human thing. A full belly with good food, that's an animal thing, not a human thing. A comfortable bed is an animal thing, not a human thing. And if you think to yourself how you perform in an uncomfortable chair, uncomfortable feet. And our cows are employees like that, and we have to take care of them and make them feel well.
Wow, cows as employees. That's a way to put it. You know, regardless of the animal welfare concerns, and I hear both of you on the third-party inspections and so forth, what about, Jamie, the move towards more plant-based diets by a lot of people these days and the fights over sort of oat milk and soy? Well, soy milk's been around for a long time. Rice milk, oat milk, soy milk. Cashew
sure,
milk,
almond milk.
Is that a competition for you, or is it just
it
a
is.
Whole different
it's
thing?
It's a huge competition for us, and I could go on for hours, and I have gone on with Beth for hours about it. But basically, you know, they usurped our good name We really feel strongly that it should be plant-based beverages. Very upset about it being milk. There's actually laws that say it can't be, but no one will enforce them. Plant butter is the latest one that I'm ready to go to court over. And that's fine to have your choice that you don't support an animal industry and you want a product that's not. It's America. That's what we're about. But you can't call it milk. And it has drastically hurt our milk price in New Hampshire dairy farms. It takes a tiny percentage of overproduction. You know, less than 2% overproduction will cut our price by more than 30%.
Go ahead, Beth.
I think the hardest part with this is just that, you know, it's created fear in people, and that's not what we want people to feel about their food. You know, it's large companies trying to differentiate themselves, and they often use fear as a way to market. And so, you know, so what we're finding is that people have more questions now, and they're more uncomfortable and they're more scared. And I think that they need to remember that they don't need to be afraid of the foods we produce. We produce incredibly safe products, and we are well regulated. And, you know, and we want consumers to have choice. We just, you know, also want them to think about the benefits beyond just into air quality, you know, the rural communities in New Hampshire and, you know, things like that, that you're benefiting by purchasing our products.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
Just the one last thing I'd say is that my cows have been turning plants into milk for millions of years, and they're pretty good at it.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for the email. That is something I wanted to ask you about because, again, every time you go to the grocery store, there's another plant-based milk on the shelf.
Beverage.
thank you, Dan, for the email. Henry asks, I'm a young college student who has worked on a variety of farms around New Hampshire and Vermont. I'm very passionate about this industry and would love to become a farmer. However, I am worried about how I can afford it. All the farmers I have met really struggle with finances, at least early on, and I would worry about being able to buy land and sustain myself and my future family being a farmer. What do your guests suggest? And Henry, thank you so much. And Kate, I'll turn to you first.
Sure. I think land access and also access to financing to start up a farm are really serious challenges.
Yeah, land's expensive in New Hampshire.
Yes. And so because of that, at least in the Seacoast area, leasing land has become a really common and often really successful way for farmers to get started without going into debt with a huge mortgage right away. And sometimes it allows a few years of building a market and developing skills and acquiring the equipment and infrastructure piece in addition to the land is another huge barrier. We got to our farm, we bought our land in 2012, and we're really still one piece at a time putting the necessary tools and infrastructure in place. And we can't afford to do it all at once, and it would be impossible. But it does take some time. But with the right landowner, sometimes leasing can be a stepping stone, and that's what we did. We leased land before we were able to buy, and we were able to develop a track record with our lenders proving that we knew how to grow food and we knew how to sell it. And we've been, you know, continuing to build that customer base ever since.
I've heard from other farmers, Kate, and tell me if this is your case or if this is the case for other farmers you know, that one person runs the farm and the other person has the job with the health insurance and the steady paycheck.
I think that is common, although I can think of a lot of examples that are not exactly that. I have friends who, you know, one is a vegetable farmer, and then, you know, their spouse is a cheesemaker. So both maybe marketing to some of the same customers, but running two businesses on the same farm. But in my case, my husband does work off the farm, and he is very involved in the farm and has a huge role on the farm when he's there. But Monday through Friday, he's at his job, and we do have health insurance through his employer, and so that can be a stabilizing factor.
What do you think, Beth?
I think it's incredibly challenging to get into farming. Dairy farming is pretty capital intensive. You know, there's a lot of equipment, there's animals, things like that. I think, you know, it's hard to tell whether the emailer was looking at something like that. But there are, there's an aging population of farmers, and our land is going to be changing hands. And there are a lot of farms where family members are not as ecstatic about joining the business as Jamie's are. And so, you know, there are places, you know, there's a director for our co-op, Deb Erb. They're from Landoff Creamery, and they have a business. They milk about 65 cows, and she and her husband would like to retire, and they're looking for a farmer to come in and work for them for a period of time.
I hope our emailer's still listening. Yeah.
There are definitely opportunities out there. It's going to require hard work. It's going to require, you know, sort of finding that match with somebody that has a similar, you know.
It can be done. It can be done. It's hard, and if financial well-being is something that concerns you, probably agriculture isn't it, because even long-established farms, cash flow is almost always a real – and I assume that's true in most small businesses, but in ag, it really is. And if that's something that you can't sleep with at night, you probably ought to find something else to do.
Well, we got an email, again, towards that effect from Gene, who is at Hungry Bear Farm in Mason. So, wow, thank you, Gene. He says, I would like to note on your initial comment that New Hampshire farms have a high percentage of direct sales to consumers. I've heard this statistic for years now, and it is a bit misleading. It conjures up images of New Hampshire farms being very successful. It does not mean that we farmers all have enough customers to thrive. Rather, it means that of the customers we do have, most are being sold to directly by us. Gene says many farms in our area have gone out of business in the last 10 years, and of the farms left, we are all looking for more local customers. Absolutely understood, Gene. I really appreciate you sort of expanding upon that statistic. It sounds good, but there's a lot more to it. So, Jamie, your thoughts there?
Very true. It's the local movement is certainly alive and well, but it's still a tiny percentage of the population, you know, and we live in Kentuckook, which, as you know, is just west of Concord here, and we pretty much have to turn right when we hit 93 because you take that percentage and there's going to be the population there because it's pretty much the same percentage, and whether you want to call it 3% or 7%, 7% of Monroe, New Hampshire, or 7% of Nashua. You got to be in Nashua.
You got to be in Nashua, right. And in a way, it's the old model. I mean, even many, many, many years ago, farmers would truck their wares to market on Sunday or Saturday or whatever day it was, and then go back. And there's stories of farmers traveling many days to get their produce to market and so forth. Do you want to jump in, Kate, on our emailer's question?
Sure. I think it's a really, really important point because there's a lot of food being produced, and the farmer not only needs to grow the food, but find customers who will come and buy it. And that part of our job often takes a tremendous amount of our time.
It's a lot of time.
And it's not done necessarily efficiently, but, you know, we have a really diversified marketing situation at our farm just by necessity. I would love to just have a CSA or just have a farm store, but there's no way I could sell everything we're growing just through one marketing channel that is really efficiently run. So therefore, we are doing all the administrative stuff behind farmers market, wholesale and sales to restaurants, and CSA, and we have two different kinds of CSA memberships, just trying to market ourselves really creatively. And still, we are growing more food than we can sell, and our community as a whole, our farming community as a whole, is growing a lot more food than we're able to sell at the price that we need to get.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. So, because it relates again to the statistic, which sounds good, but there's a lot more to it. Go ahead, Jamie.
The other thing that really happens is, especially in dairy farming, a lot of the dairy farmers stay in dairy farming because they don't really like the interaction with people. And you know, you're real good at growing crops at home, but that marketing is a real challenge.
Yeah, so you have to be good at the farming and good at the business end of it, which I wonder, some people are probably good at one or the other, but...
Or the marketing end of it.
Yeah.
A lot of farmers are good at farming and business, but then you throw marketing in there too, and it's something that they're uncomfortable with.
Well, here's an email from Regina, who says, we operate a vegetable farm, Longview Farm in Plymouth. Food access is really important to us. We believe local food should be an everyday product available to as many people as possible. We offer SNAP at our farm stand. That's the food stamps, basically, participate in Got Lunch, which is a summer food assistance program, and really try to understand our customer base and their financial realities in terms of food buying. We do not feel we are undercutting our product, and we're not interested in driving the price or buying into the idea that local food has to be a high-cost product. How do the panelists balance this issue? This is a great question, Regina. Thank you so much for emailing. What do you think, Beth? Local food has this sort of boutique, expensive image among some people.
Well, I think, you know, in order to get a return, you know, our costs are higher in our state. They just are. You know, our costs are higher to get product to market. Our costs, our land costs are higher, things like that. So there has to be a certain amount built in to make sure that we can make a living at this and we can continue to operate our farm. We're not going to be sustainable if we're not economically sustainable. So, but, you know, that being said, you know, we try to make our product as, you know, as cost effective as we can. You know, we know our costs, like Kate has said before, you know, and knowing your costs is a big part of it, so that you know when you walk into that, you know, and talk to somebody about selling your product, you know exactly what you need to get for it in order to make sure that there is a piece of the return. But unfortunately, for us as dairy farmers, you know, both Jamie and I belong to a cooperative and sell, in my case, it's 80% of my milk still goes to the cooperative, 20% goes into my individual product. And the cooperative has its benefits in that I know that that product can be sold. I know that our cooperative, its own Cabot Cheese, has an awesome brand, and we hope that, you know, that brand will help generate extra funds for us as farmers. But that price is set on a world level, not, you know, our price is set on a national scale, but it's influenced by world markets. It's not just our own rural area. And so, you know, that cost has been, you know, dismal for the last 5 years. So while it's exciting that we make a product and have an opportunity to bring it to people, it's also scary to know that there's that other part of the business, the sort of the wholesale part of the business, has struggled really in the last 5 years.
How do you balance that out, Jamie?
I think we decided that we have a tremendous amount of support in the public, in our town and in the Concord area. And I think that the idea is that it does cost more to make the product here. And I don't know that I do apologize that ours costs more. I still market a tremendous amount wholesale that we can't make a living on. The co-op isn't making money at it. We aren't making money at it. It's been terrible for 5 years. We're all hanging on by our fingernails. And good, high-quality food that's produced locally is something that's worth investing in.
Kate, I'd love to hear from you, too.
Sure. Yeah, this is a really important question. And living in a community with diverse incomes, it's really important to us that our farm feels like a place where everyone is welcome. And at farmers markets, the being able to accept SNAP at farmers markets has been really critical.
That's relatively new, isn't it, Kate?
Well, Seacoast eLocal in our area has been coordinating SNAP at farmers markets for, and I don't know exactly how many years that's been happening, but for us, it feels like a really long time.
Okay.
The winter farmers markets that Seacoast eLocal runs, which are amazing, are, I think, in their 13th year, and SNAP came a few years after that. But access points at farmers markets throughout our region and throughout the state are a really important thing to have in place, I think. And we've been able to meet customers at market, but because that program exists and draws people to market, we've made connections with customers that way who can then find us at the farm store.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about an issue that I know is affecting New Hampshire farmers across the state, and that's climate change. So we'll tackle that after a short break. And we'll keep taking your emails, your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. Once again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. More with New Hampshire's farmers in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Giving Tuesday is a chance for you to celebrate the organizations that benefit your community by giving back. Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. And when you donate to NHPR, you can extend your generosity by giving meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank at the same time. Contribute $10 a month and pay forward your thank you gift. Instead of choosing a mug, choose to give 10 meals to the food bank. Give today at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a new book on George Washington's approach toward Native Americans. That's Tuesday morning, live at 9. This hour, a panel of New Hampshire farmers is with us on the challenges they face and why they love what they do. Let's hear from you, too. Your questions about farming, whether your family used to farm but has left the business, or whether you've dreamed about working in this sector yourself. We'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to the phones. And Jordan's on the line. Hi, Jordan. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Kate. How's it going?
Hi, Jordan.
I have a question here. I know climate change is coming up, or like as a topic. So I would like to ask how that affects like methods of production for all of you in your various different farm industries, like challenges it presents, but also how it makes you like rethink how to go about producing, you know, dairy products or, in your case, state vegetables.
Well, Jordan, it's a great question. And Kate, I was wondering about this, too, especially since you were literally planting vegetables in the soil. And we've seen these large rain events and we've seen droughts and we've seen early winters and late springs, and the weather has been crazy. So how much is this affecting your farm?
Well, first of all, I love that we just got a call from one of my farm crew. Thank you, Jordan.
Full disclosure.
And great question. The severe weather events are definitely a concern. We're obviously farming and we're already at the mercy of the weather in terms of the health of our crops. But damaging winds and flooding and those and the severe drought years that we had two in a row, those have been big challenges. And that really means we need to be focusing on the health of our soils, you know, more than ever, because in order to have a resilient ecosystem on the farm, our soil is really the backbone of that system and our production system. And things like erosion and the amount of organic matter in the soil and whether we're planting cover crops and all of those things really matter. And so we're really looking ahead at how, you know, all the different ways we can really focus on soil health in the future. And a big part of that for us, actually, the last couple of years, we've been leasing our pasture land to our friends at Clyde Farm, and they raise pastured poultry on the property on the parts of our farm that we're not using for vegetables. And so having a partnership with other farms that are also other farmers who are helping us repair some depleted soils and things like that.
Are you getting into greenhousing, Kate? How much is that a part of the process?
So we have four hoop houses. One of them is heated. And so energy consumption on the farm is also another thing that I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, choosing to develop infrastructure that requires the use of electricity, like a furnace or, you know, we have walk-in coolers that use air conditioners to cool them and things like that. We don't take those things lightly. And so we were actually able to put solar panels on our barn a couple of years ago. And so we're now producing over 90% of the electricity that our farm and our house is using on the farm.
Wait, you're producing most of your own electricity right there?
Yes. So that feels really good as a step. We worked with Revision Energy to make that happen. And there are some really good incentive, state and federal incentive programs to help with that. But that means that we can have infrastructure on the farm that is using electricity, and also feel good about being able to counteract that usage.
Right. Beth, how about you, either on your own farm, the impacts of climate change, or in your broader role as president of Cheshire County Farm Bureau?
So I live in the Connecticut River Valley, and we're seeing more competition. The land that had been at probably, they say, has been under cultivation for 1,000 years along the Connecticut River. The vegetable farmers from Massachusetts are moving further north. My own town, a farm that used to be a dairy farm, is now a vegetable farm. And that's not necessarily, I think it's just that the season is getting more attractive. You know, it's a little longer season. They can grow some crops they might not have been able to grow. So there's that sense of competition. But I do want to mention, as in my role at Farm Bureau, that we just had our recent annual meeting, and at the delegate session, we had about six different policies we were discussing related to climate change. So farmers are talking about this. We really, really, really want to be part of the discussion. You know, we can do a lot to mitigate, you know, getting carbon into the soil and improving our soils does great things for the state, for for, you know, and for our own farms to produce. So again, it's kind of a pet thing for me, but I really would like to see, you know, when conversations are starting to happen at the State House, that they look to farmers, because we can be, you know, champions of this.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Yeah, we certainly, soil health, like Kate said, is huge. And getting the organic matter up in the soil so that it does hold moisture when we get it and doesn't wash it away, and keeping a crop on top of it. We've gone to intensively growing cover crops on all our corn grounds, so we try and keep our ground green all year round. That keeps the bio underneath alive. We've gone to doing complete no-till on all our corn production so that we aren't busting up that organic matter and releasing that carbon.
Oh, that's interesting. That's an important point, isn't it?
For us, it is. It's it allows us to bind up tremendous amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere. And we're working on our carbon footprint at the moment between our cropland and our forest land. I'm hoping that we're going to be a carbon sink when we get all done. I haven't gotten there yet, but that's what we're shooting for. And I think, you know, cows don't like the heat spells. We really suffer in the hot. We do a lot to try and keep cows comfortable, but they're kind of like marathon runners. And when we get those real hot weeks, they get really stressed over it. They do much better in the cold. Cold doesn't bother cows at all. But that summer heat is something that we're trying to learn with.
And we forgot to mention this in the beginning when we were describing your operation, Jamie. You know, we said you produce your own milk, your own cheese, you sort of sell it yourself, you distribute it yourself, but you also grow the feed for your cows, right?
About,
right there.
We grow about 50% of the feed for the cows. So we grow the forages, and forages are grass, legumes, and corn. Lots of times people forget that corn is a grass, but corn is a grass. And we feed the whole plant of corn to the cows 50%. We also feed, then we buy in about 50% of what we call concentrates or grains that come in from a plant, a grain plant in Vermont.
Well, Jason sent us a tweet who says, a voice or voices missing from this conversation are the voices of North Country farmers like Meadowstone Farm in Bethlehem and New Earth Organic Farm in Colebrook. Jesse says, I get the sense from this conversation that the northern folks think about these issues differently. Jesse, criticism well taken. I really appreciate our guests all coming in. North Country, absolutely. You know, we'd love to hear from them. It is hard for farmers to get away from the farm and to make the trip to Concord, but it's a great point.
Same trends in the North Country, too. I mean, Beth and I are friends with Scott Mason at Northwind Farms. It milks cows and has vegetables on the side of the road, Barron Route 3, and there's in Landaff Farm. It's that they're in Landaff that are marketing their own cheese and lack the population to sell to real close. But
yeah, that's the thing. And you spoke about that earlier, Jamie, how important it is to be able to sell your products in a Nashua or a Concord and so forth. So you don't have that so much in the North Country.
We cover Belknap, Hillsborough, Rockingham, Merrimack, Stratford County, and that's 90% of the state's population.
Wow.
In those four counties.
Kate, any thoughts about colleagues in the North Country? And Jesse, I really appreciate you writing us.
Yeah, I think that it's a valid point, and I think access to a population that, you know, is your potential customer base is really a challenge in the more rural parts of the state. I grew up in Sunapee, and I've thought about, well, what if I'd gone back to Sunapee to farm? It would be more challenging to build all those relationships and a smaller population, and our marketing would look really different. On the seacoast, we do have the luxury of having access to a lot of people. One thing I think that's interesting is there's a lot of collaboration among farmers that's popping up in the North Country and in our area as well on the distribution front. So working together, I mean, sometimes it's just really impractical to drive the distances to deliver your food, whether to restaurants or, you know, there are a lot of farms that are partnering on CSAs and multi-farm CSAs are definitely a concept that's catching on, so that every farm doesn't have to do everything themselves. So I think there are a lot of opportunities for collaboration and just really thinking through travel routes and ways to work together to decrease time on the road and get the food where it needs to go, where the customers are.
Go ahead, Beth.
The other thing I would add is, you know, in the North Country, your customer base may be even more apt to purchase food in larger quantities. You know, we're dealing with, you know, a more urban dweller who might not have a large freezer to put half a cow, but somebody in the North Country might do that as a matter of course. And, you know, so there are definitely advantages, you know, in that case to working there. And I think, you know, the farms throughout the state are important. You know, I don't want to admit, you know, to say that they aren't. You know, we need that land and cultivation. We need, you know, we need our farmers, you know, across the state. And so, you know, I think everyone's going to have some different strategies to make things work for their own business. And again, yes, we are in the southern part of the state where, you know, there are more customers and more customer base. But I think, like I said, there's a place for all of us at the table.
Well, Jesse, again, I really appreciate the note. Lots of other comments that I'd love to share with our listeners. Representative Judith Spang wrote in. She says, you should mention that the state of New Hampshire supports farming with two programs that buy easements on farmland. These are the Moose Plate Program and LCHIP, the Land and Community Investment Program. Representative Spang says, struggling farmers can sell development rights while keeping their land and continuing to farm it. Farms with easements can also be sold or passed on to the next generation without high taxes. So that's from Representative Spang. Anybody want to comment on state policy and supporting farms? Go ahead, Jamie.
We actually sold the development rights in our farm.
What does that mean exactly?
So that means that we still own the property, but we sold off the right to do any building on that property that isn't agriculturally related. And it was a win-win situation for us, but that's something as farmers that's really scary to go into, because even though you never plan on developing your land, it's your fastest growing asset and you're always mortgaged against that asset.
And well, especially since you're near a major population center, Concord.
And anywhere, big chunks of land are worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And as soon as you sell the development rights on it, you slow that value growth. And we hope that we didn't tie future generations. You know, it's the fifth generation is there, and it's something that we felt we had to do to bring the fifth generation back in. But hopefully that doesn't tie the sixth or seventh generation's hands.
Grayson Henniker writes, what about GMO seeds? Do our farmers use them? Kate?
No, is the short answer. As a certified organic farm, GMO seeds would not be allowed in our production system at all. And that's a really clear part of the rule. I think, and maybe Jamie can touch on this, I think corn is probably one of the more common ways that GMO seed, you know, works its way into our food system. But I really like being a certified organic farm. This is a great example of why it makes it easier to communicate with customers about what goes into growing the food and what our philosophy is about that. But GMO seeds, it's important to me that they are not part of what we're doing.
Jamie?
We buy commercial grain. We don't buy organic grain, so I'm sure that we are feeding GMOs. We believe in the science behind GMOs. We believe in the science behind climate change, and we believe those same scientific methods are used to prove things like GMOs are safe.
And Beth, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just echo what Jamie said, that, you know, we have a safe food supply. It's well documented and tested. You know, in our own products that we make, we actually purchase non-GMO ingredients to put in it, but that's because of maybe the customers that are purchasing it might ask a question. And so rather than have to answer the question, but I purchase feed that for my cattle that is grown with genetic modification. And I think those traits are a benefit. You know, they actually have led to, you know, improvements in, you know, the drought resistance to that crop and, you know, those traits that have a benefit on the farm. And so I think that's important for people to remember and to remember that, you know, again, this is another example of sort of that fear marketing that's made people uncomfortable about their food. I don't want people to be scared about their food. You know, we produce incredibly safe food. It's well regulated. And we, you know, we want to make sure people feel confident when they eat products. Whoever you are and whatever products you purchase, they are safe and they are good.
And the organic market is out there for the folks that want that choice. And I think that's important, too.
Well, I want to ask you very quickly about a topic that has affected farmers nationwide that we're hearing about, but I'm not so sure in New Hampshire. And Jamie, I'll ask you, we've heard a lot from farmers in Iowa, where all the presidential candidates are, that trade wars are really hurting farmers. But is that true for the small New Hampshire farmer like yourself as well?
New Hampshire dairy farmers, it's been devastating to us.
Really?
The last 24 months. Yeah, milk price was just starting to come up when they put the trade embargoes on China. We probably lost easily 15% of our milk price for the last 24 months over that, which equates to hundreds of thousands of dollars on our farm. And, you know, our two biggest trading partners in dairy are Mexico and China. It's just been horrible on the dairy industry. Beth can speak.
So even for a small farmer
like
you,
New Hampshire farm milking, if you're milking 20 cows and selling it commercially, selling it into the wholesale market, you've had your milk price. It's just started to come back up now in the last 3 months.
Wow. Okay. Beth, real quick.
Our co-op saw a decrease in, you know, in their profit. You know, like it was directly attributable to not being able to sell this, you know, whey protein concentrate to China. You know, and again, we are in a world market, whether we want to be or not, our products are, and so we need to keep that in mind, and you know, and that becomes part of the conversation.
Well, ending on an up note, Elizabeth in Jaffrey says we have a small farm in the sense that we produce almost everything we eat, animal and vegetable products. Elizabeth says, I wish people knew the true cost of their food when they consider what they are willing to pay for it. Farmers deserve to earn a living. Loving what they do is not enough. Elizabeth, thank you so much for that email. And so that gets us to Thanksgiving. If we could just talk about that for a moment. I've got a chart in front of me that says the farmer's share of your Thanksgiving dinner. Just an example, mashed potatoes, 5 pounds. Retail price is about $4.50. The farmer gets 67 cents of that. So that's just kind of following up on what Judith says. Can you reflect on Thanksgiving, Kate, and what at that table is going to be either from your farm or locally? I'm guessing it's a lot.
Yeah, the vegetables we grow are kind of, it's, you know, the timing of our harvest in the fall.
It's perfect,
really,
isn't it?
All kind of culminates in the Thanksgiving meal. Yeah, I'm thinking about all the people who picked up their Thanksgiving shares over the weekend and hearing about all the family recipes that they, you know, that they're making. And tomorrow I'll bring my parents their Thanksgiving share and their Clyde Farm turkey. And we'll do some cooking together. Yeah.
How about you, Jamie? How local is your Thanksgiving table? I'm guessing a lot.
It'll be pretty local. We'll certainly have local cheese and eggnog and vegetables and heading down to Mom's to have a great meal with the family.
Beth?
My mom puts on a fantastic meal, and we buy as much local as we can, and of course have pudding for dessert.
I was going to say, I can guess what you're having on top of your pumpkin pie. Pudding instead of ice cream.
Yes, and you know, as farmers, we thank, you know, people of New Hampshire for purchasing our products. You know, we need you, and we appreciate you at this time of year. Thank
well,
you.
Well, it's great to talk to all of you. Thank you so much, and I know this is a really busy time of year for you as well, as Kate said earlier, so thank you for your time, and Beth, it was nice to meet you.
Thank you
for coming
so much.
In. That's Beth Hodge. She runs Echo Farm Pudding in Hinsdale with her sister. She's president of the Cheshire County Farm Bureau. Jamie, it was great to meet you. Thank you.
Awesome to be here. Thanks for having us.
Jamie Robertson with his family. He's owner of Contoocook Creamery at the Bohannon Farm in Contoocook. And Kate, thank you for making the trip. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
That's Kate Donald. She owns and runs Stout Oak Farm with her husband. That's an organic vegetable farm in Brentwood. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.